Yomihi Nui and a very good morning to you, Auckland. It's 5 minutes past nine and you're listening to 104.6 Planet FM. My guest today is Chris Barfoot, talking about Tohono O'odham. How long have you been working with the Tohono O'odham Reserve?
Well, it started when I got married and we bought a house here. That was in 1971. And well, we moved in 1971, and Pat's my wife, and we've been married 44 years. We're still here.
Wow.
And we moved in beginning of 1971, and just about a year later, we moved in here because we always loved the bush, and we met through tramping and New Zealand bush and mountains and so on, and all the family have been involved in that sort of thing, and we just loved the outlook over the river here and the reserve, and so. But we were a bit disappointed when we, after about a year, we moved in. We've discovered the council we're going to put a tip right in front of us.
I read that they were going to put an inorganic tip. What, between the sandspit and the land? Was that the plan?
Yes, all over the sandspit, really, basically just right in front of us.
What on earth possessed them? Well, I won't ask. The question did that lead to the formation of the Tamaki Estuary?
No, it started 3 years before that, when I wasn't there then, but there was another proposal to reclaim all the land around here, including the big bay between here and Glendowie Boating Club, to reclaim it for a residential marina, you know, the whole of the sandspit and most of the bay beyond it, for residential marina. And the local people were pretty concerned about this, and they formed a group to fight it, and that group was called the Tamaki Estuary Protection Society.
Okay.
And that's where it started, and they were successful.
And it's still going?
It's still going, yes, very, yes. I'm on the committee still, and we had a meeting last night, and very positive.
Okay, so have you been involved with the Protection Society right from the beginning? Or?
No, not from 1969. I came in when the tip proposal came up, and we asked the society if they would come in and fight the battle for us, and they did, and so we all became members of the society of people around here, and took part in the campaign to stop the tip. So it was the Tamaki Estuary Protection Society that defeated both proposals.
That's incredible. So you got involved to stop the tip, and then what happened after that, just in terms of the progression? Because obviously, well, as I read on the council website, it, effectively at that point it was just it was considered a wasteland.
Yes. It started with the battle. We were anxious not to be thought of as NIMBYs. You know the term NIMBYs?
I do.
Not in my own backyard.
I do, yes.
So that's their only interest in opposing things. And it was just basically self-centered, you see. So we said, no, it's a better use for the land. And it should be it was Ronald Lockley, a British naturalist, who'd worked with Sir Peter Scott in England, establishing nature reserves. He had moved into the neighbourhood. In fact, we'd sold a house to him. That's why I knew he was
right,
because he loved the birds, you know, around here. And he, so we enlisted his support, and he looked at, yes, it could be a nature reserve. Well, New Zealand's first, I suppose, and it could be a nature reserve like we've done in England. And so that was the campaign was fought on. What do you prefer, you know, to the people around the community? What do you prefer, a tip or a nature reserve, you see?
That's a hard choice to make, isn't it? So what state was it in at this point?
Well, it had been farmed, and it had been an adjunct to the whole area around here was farmed, and that's up to about the 1950s, I suppose. Then it was subdivided, and Auckland sort of spread out, and the whole area was subdivided. And so this area that was it was sort of an adjunct to the farming which went on here, it became a bit more isolated and hardly economic to farm, you know, to farm on its own, because it wasn't big enough and it's pretty wet and so on. And right. So they it just reverted, and farmland, when it's left so it's on its own, just reverts to weeds, you probably...
sure, the weeds are the first to move back
yeah,
in.
Yeah, and just about every weed you could find in Auckland was found here.
Foreign and domestic.
Gorse, blackberry, ringweed, fennel, you know, wattles, privet, the whole range of Auckland weeds.
Right, but despite that, it was still full of bird life?
That was the land part. The other part, the sort of coastal part, the mudflats and so on, remained a very good for waders, and the waders were very significant. Have always been very significant around here.
Right, and Tahunatoria does mean the gathering of oyster catchers or something like that.
Gathering place of oyster catchers. Tahuna is the gathering place, and Toria is an onomatopoeic word. Meaning is representing the cry of the oyster catcher, Toria, Toria.
Ah,
that's a very
okay.
The word is full of meaning.
Absolutely.
The gathering places are the sandbanks or the mudflats where the oyster catchers gather.
So there were lots of waders about, particularly out on the spits.
That's right.
And lots of weeds on the land side, so to speak.
Lots of weeds, yeah. That's right. The land side was a farm, a neglected farm, you might say. When we decided to go ahead, we had to sort of go ahead with the plans that we'd footed on that basis that it was to be a nature reserve. So immediately the TIP was... proposal was defeated in 1972. We asked the council to create make it into a nature reserve, you see, and they kind of they went along gradually, went along with it, although they're a bit disappointed their proposal was knocked back. But they kind of go and so we discussed it with them, and we formed a committee with them and to develop the area. Well, not that develop's not quite the right word, because we didn't propose develop in the sense of reclaiming things like that, but we wanted to make it more suitable for birds and to create more habitats. You see, there had only been one habitat really before, and that was for the wading birds, and we wanted to create a habitat for water birds. So we raised the water level by creating ponds and wetlands and so on.
Oh.
And then we also wanted to make it a habitat for bush birds by planting, you know, bird-attracting trees. So in the end, we finished up with three different habitats, three different forms and three different types of birds.
And as part of the restoration, this was, for want of a better word, a man-made... set of three ecosystems, basically using what you had there, obviously.
Yes, it was very much a volunteer project right from the beginning, because the residents around here who'd joined together to oppose the TIP also continued to, as it were, they were appointed as rangers, basically, to look after the reserve and to help with the... things like planting and making tracks and so on, and sort of acting as rangers, preventing any undesirable behavior, you know, motorbikes or anything like that.
Right, because primarily this is about a nature reserve. It's not a park for humans, so to speak. It's not a recreation park for humans.
Yeah, it's both. It's both. It's a is a public public access with it's quite an important part of it, and so people can enjoy the wildlife and enjoy the trees, and they go. We started making tracks through the bush, and the weed control was quite a major in the early years. We had to get in control of all these weeds that covered the area, and we did that basically by planting trees, you know, and which overtopped the gorse and so on. The gorse died, and
You've got a canopy.
Yes, that's why when they couldn't get any sun, and the same with fennel, and so we made all these tracks, and we formed all these ponds, and nearly all of the initial work, either excavation and so on of the ponds and things, was there, and the making of tracks and planting was done by volunteers. It still is, actually, still is, but.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, and were they primarily from the local community?
Yes, local community, local schools, and scout groups, and service groups, and so on. And we raised the money to pay for organisations like Acclimatisation Society and Forest and Bird paid for the initial moving, the making of the dams. Or ponds, and then the residents paid for most of the trees to start off with, and planted them. And then later on, the council started taking over, and they now supply all the trees, for example. And, but the main work at the beginning was raising the water level. I don't know whether you've been out here at all, but whether you know what it's like, but.
I haven't done the full set of trails, I must confess.
No.
And
no.
And the more I've read about it, the more excited I've been, and I've realized that I've missed an opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It was. Yes, we've been planting for 40 years, and the trees that we planted are now in a mature forest, and there's nice trees, and so people enjoy that, and we have. It's got quite an educational significance. The local schools use it quite a lot for studying. Well, they can study all sorts of things here. They can study the birds. They can study the trees. They can study the insects, the marine ecology, zoology, and the Maori history.
Right, because it was occupied... I originally assumed it was going to be Ngāti Whātua, but it wasn't. It was Ngāti Pau. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Ngāti Pau were the tangata whenua here by virtue of a marriage settlement back in the late 18th century. And they were, Ngāti Whātua gave them the land as a marriage gift to kind of to protect them on the eastern flank, really.
Right,
as good warriors.
It makes perfect sense to me. This is how things were done.
they had been in the area, but been a bit of a nuisance.
Right,
Ngāti Whātua,
and then it was overrun by Ngā Pui briefly.
Yes, the whole whole isthmus was. But particularly around this area, there was a great slaughter up the river at Panmure, or Makui was the Maori name. That was the centre of the Ngāti Whātua, Ngāti Pāua tribe, and that was one of the. They came down with their muskets, and I think they had about 1,000, and the Ngāti Pāua had about 3, and so it was a big massacre, and the. They left the area, went down the Firth of Thames here, also the Ngāti Whātua seemed to left the area too. So when about 1840, it was there weren't many people here and many Maori people here. So it was the land. They were quite the Ngāti Whātua sold their land to the Crown. The Crown sold it to settlers, and it was farmed, became, you know,
it was put under cultivation.
Pastoral mainly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Town milk supply sort of thing, dairy farms.
All right, yeah, General William Taylor is who...
Yes, he was, he had owned a lot of the land around here, but the, Glenn Taylor, and, Glenn, yeah, he but the farm, the main farm up here was owned by a family called Thompson, and then it went to different owners. The Reese family, not the Reeves family, were quite prominent here, and they sold the land to someone else, to Kerridge, that's right, Kerridge.
Okay, and...
Kerridge, and then Kerridge sold it to Myers, and... the other way around, Myers Kerridge, and then Kerridge subdivided it. That was the sort of land side of it.
Right, okay, and then eventually what the council wanted to turn into a tip became council land.
Yes, what the reserve was always set aside as... in Sanford, it was set aside as a reserve owned by the Crown.
Okay.
And it was called Glen Innes Domain.
Oh, okay.
So the tip proposal was to be on Crown land.
Right. Right. Now, I understand that this is also a place where the Godwits stop. Is it once or twice a year?
They used to. We don't have quite so many now. We've got various problems, but one of the main ones is the growth of mangroves. And the areas which the birds fed on, the tidal lagoon in the middle of the reserve, has been invaded by mangroves over the last 20, 30 years. And so the mangroves have really stopped coming. We still have a lot of other birds, but they haven't, you can't really say it's a, it's a major,
right. Okay.
Godwit place now.
Right, because
that's one of the things that we're trying to tackle is the management of the mangroves, so to bring back the areas for bird feeding.
Right, and is the tidal lagoon? I mean, it's a chicken and egg thing, but which came first, the silt, which brought the mangroves, or the mangroves, which is bringing the silt to fill in that tidal lagoon?
Well, the area in that time, the area around upriver has been subdivided and. Huge subdivisions and development of East Tamaki and Tikaranga and so on, and the industrial stuff as well. And as a result, a lot of silt has come down the river. And
of course.
And that's resulted in an abnormal, abnormal growth of mangroves right through the estuary, but including Ternateria.
Yep, that's the natural succession once the silt arrives.
It's anthropomorphic, really.
yes, driven by runoff from human development.
Yeah.
Wow, okay, so fewer and fewer godwits because, of course, whatever they stop to feed on is no longer readily accessible.
No, we still get quite a number of the wading birds like oyster catchers and stilts and terns and so on, but and herons and spoonbills, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we get a good variety, but...
So what is the future bringing? You know, what are the plans that the Protection Society has going forward? Obviously, dealing with the mangrove issue is one of them.
Yes, well, we've had the various problems. The weeds, I suppose, were the main problem, which are now basically overcome. We've got on top of them and replaced them with native bush now. And
that's a huge success.
Yes, it's been a great success.
Auckland is one of the weediest cities in the world.
It is. It's the weed capital of the world.
Yeah, and to even have that small victory, and it's not a small area, what is it, 25 hectares, that's pretty good.
It's quite good, you see. And so the weeds, then we had erosion problems on the southwestern shore, which we fixed. That took a while. And that was one of the reasons for making for the tip to stabilise the erosion, of course. So we had to tackle that one. And then another one is dogs. Dogs were disturbing the birds. You know, they're running after them and all that.
Of course,
in the area.
Yes.
It was a favourite dog walking area, and they, up till about 10 years ago. And we had to look at, had to face this issue because we couldn't have both a dog walking area and a wildlife sanctuary.
You're right. And so dogs are currently banned from that area,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it's a dog-free area. It's the only reserve in Auckland, I think, that is dog-free at the moment.
Right, okay. And you don't have a problem with feral cats or...
Oh, there are feral cats, yes. Yes, we do. We have a problem with cats. I don't know quite how we deal with that because they can't... They're not so easy to control.
No, no. That's right. And I suppose there's some pest control happening?
Yes, we have pest control. We've had that for the last 11 years, and that was necessary because of the possums eating the young trees and quite a number, and rats and mice. And that's been pretty successful in controlling these pests.
And
that again is a volunteer job.
I was just going to say, who does that? But is it
local residents, basically?
It's local residents, and in concert with Auckland Council. And
Auckland Council runs the scheme, yes.
Okay, and because I interviewed somebody a couple of months ago trapping in kappa bush as a volunteer.
Oh yes.
Also via Auckland Council and what is it, Conservation Volunteers.
Oh yes, they're a good group.
Mm. Yeah. So what's coming up in the future? I mean, what projects have the Protection Society got on the books right now?
Well, we've named the we've put tree signs up to give details of we're about 25 to 30 tree signs up so that people can study the trees as they go through, and they've got all sorts of details about what the trees were, and they're used both by Maori and Pākehā, which is quite interesting, like Tautra and so on. And then we've got, we just put in half a dozen insect signs, and we hope to have a few more there. Also give details of all the insects that live on the trees, and there's millions, you know, there's thousands.
What I was going to say, what sort of insects are there that are of interest, if you know what I mean?
Well, you say they get the puri moth.
Okay.
Which makes holes in the trees, and people wonder what they are. And then there's the cabbage tree mite, which makes holes in cabbage tree leaves. And the Pitakawa mite that makes just the same with, But you see the what they do, by the colored discoloration of the leaves or the holes or something, and but you don't actually see the insects. They're too microscopic. You can only see them under a microscope.
Can only see their effects.
Yes, but they're wonderful signs because they show the three stages, you know, egg, the pupa, and the caterpillar and the moth. And they also got a link with a... smartphone like we have in supermarkets.
All right.
So it's all up-to-date technology.
Right. So I could show up with my smartphone, head down the path, and literally get a tour.
That's right. Yes, and goes up to the focuses. Smartphone will give you the actual description. Not just the website, the description of that particular mite, several pages of it sometimes.
Wow. Okay. And, of course, that's going to make... that's going to get young people interested.
That's right, yes. And it helps the educational side. And I think everyone's interested. Because insects are probably the most prolific of... But you don't see them.
That's right. Oh no, they own the planet. It's just that we don't see them.
And yet they do a great job, you know, in the food cycle and so on.
Yeah, they are the ones holding it all together.
Decomposition, things like that. Yeah.
That's right. So you've spent roughly 44 years in the neighborhood, and you've put a tremendous amount of love and effort into into this reserve.
Yes, yes, that's right. When I was working, I couldn't, of course, give as much time as I do now. I was quite active in the business and director and so on. And,
right.
But I was 40 years in the business, and I've always worked, even in the business, and but now I've had a bit more time and able to and still reasonably fit. So, although I was 40 years as chairperson of the Rangers and Residents Group, which is a local group which looks after it. And but I've just handed that over to a younger person.
Well, that's an incredible contribution to to the neighbourhood. And I don't know. I think we're all better off for it. I thought I read somewhere that it's the only restored wetland in the Auckland region.
I think so. Yes, I think so. I think it's the only area where you can get so many different habitats, three different habitats in the isthmus, so close to Auckland. Because that's why it's so useful for study, and people just enjoy walking around.
Sure.
It's great for families, and because it's a lot of, it's so interesting, different things you can see, the ponds and the bush, and of course it's the sea, it's on the sea, lovely beach on the northern side, and
right, and can you walk out on the sands?
Oh, yes, you can walk right. It's about a kilometre long. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at the map of it, and it does say walking trail, and that's part of it that I've never walked on.
Yes, you can walk right out there.
Okay, now that's...
low tide, you can walk even further.
Right, yes, because it does go quite a ways out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And can you collect pippies along there?
You used to be able to. I'm not sure, just with the... pollution, the river, just what it used to be used for food gathering by the Maori, and you have these great middens all over, in various parts of the reserve where the puppy shells. And
that's right.
But I'm not sure whether they do so. They used to, when we came here, they were still using it a bit, especially Pacific Islanders. But
okay.
I think with the pollution.
Just the silt alone may have smothered them.
No, they're not as big as they used to be, put it that way.
Right. Right. Now, I know there's a group out west that's restoring some wetlands in the Waitakere's, but they're pretty much right at the beginning, and they're fighting that weed war that you were talking about.
Oh, yes.
And they're at the beginning of that weed war. And they've got a long way to go to catch up to where your team, where your society has got to.
Yes. Oh, yes. It takes time.
Well, it takes a lot of time and a lot of commitment.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Right. So you plan to stay in the area? I mean, you're retired?
I'm retired, but we've no plans to move. We're very happy here, and... we live right on the edge of the reserve here, and like living in the city, yet we're in the country as well.
Sure, with that sort of beauty across
the bush,
street,
yeah, right, joining the bush and looking over it, and looking right over the river, and so I've been, but I've been quite involved with the river as a whole too, and, some of the things that are to reduce the erosion, measures to reduce the erosion.
Up and down the whole estuary,
yes,
or the whole river?
We had an action plan right back in 87 to clean up the river, and I was on that and still remain on it, although it's slightly different form. But so we're working with the different councils and the local stakeholders around the estuary.
Well, Chris, I think we're running out of time. Not only do I want to thank you for the interview, I want to thank you for all the time and attention you've put in to a beautiful corner of Auckland.
No, it's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you've missed anything in today's program, don't forget, you can listen again online at any time.